Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Before we get started today, I'd like to offer prayers and well wishes for myself and the entire Franchise Founder family to the victims and all loved ones affected by the recent tragedies in Boston earlier this week and in the town of West Texas last night. Our hearts go out to you as well. We'd like to extend our thanks to the first responders in both places and around the world for putting your lives on the line when tragedy strikes. The same thoughts go to your families of first responders, as your sacrifice is also greatly appreciated. Well, today is the second segment in our 8-part franchise legal series, our fourth annual franchise legal series. Hard to believe we're actually in our fourth year of doing this. And it's really been great. Michael Leibold of Clay Cook was my guest last week. We talked about franchise sales best practices. As I said to Michael during the show, a matter of fact, before the show, he said, oh, are we going to have enough to talk about for an hour? And through the show, I said, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat because we could have spoken about 3 or 4 more hours at least, I'm sure. And today's guest is Lee Plague, also Plague Cook, and we're going to be talking about data and information and responsibilities and compiling the information and what to do with it and how to secure it. And I'm sure we're going to need a bigger boat today as well. Next week, on April 25th, I'll be joined by Amy Cheng of Cheng Cohen. We'll be talking about private equity and franchising. And then the rest of the series lines up with May 2nd from DLA Piper, Barry Heller. May 9th, Mark Kirsch from Gray Plant Moody. May 16th, Lane Fisher will be back on the show. This will be his fourth year on the show. May 23rd, Jonathan Redgrave, always interesting, talking about e-discovery and again, requirements of franchisors. I'm going to wrap up with the IFA's first appearance on franchise on our franchise legal series, because they've been guests on the Franchise Today show many times. But Dean Heil, attorney on IFA staff, will be giving us a legal symposium recap. So, and that'll end the legal series. Then in June, we finalized our lineup just the other day. We're going to be talking about the franchise model. And we thought that this was a good extension beyond legal because we're spending 8 weeks on legal. And we're going to lead into the franchise model. We have four great segments. The first one will be on consumer marketing. Of course, we'll also touch about lead generation and obviously franchise candidate marketing. Ed Waller, the co-founder of CertaPro, and also the 2012 chair of the Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference, will be my guest on June 6th, followed on June 13th. We're going to be talking about operations and franchise relations, and that'll be the Bonnie Levine Award winner, Mary Thompson, president of Mr. Ruder, and, of course, the Dwyer Group. And, of course, my heart and thoughts go out to them as they're right down the road from West Texas where the explosion occurred yesterday. And that'll be June 13th. Mary will be on June 20th. Robert Stidham from Franchise Dynamics will be on. We'll be talking about franchise sales and development. And we're going to wrap up the series on June 27th. Technology and franchising, Ahmed Pemetra of FranConnect, will be on at that point. And then, of course, in the summer, we're going to be doing 8 or 9 segments in our franchise or spotlight series. It'll be the first time we're doing this. But again, I have to emphasize that this is not a promotional series. This will be strictly about best practices. And I think you're going to be very, very surprised and pleasantly surprised at some of the guests that are committing for this great series. Again, not promotional. This will be how they utilize best practices to get past startup and into an emerging successful brand today. Of course, like I always like to do, I like to recognize our strategic partners in Franchise Day. It seems like the list is growing. Of course, I like to refer to all my guests as a strategic partner because without them and the great information that they're willing and time that they're willing to share for our just tremendously growing listenership, we couldn't do it without you. But also in our strategic partners, we have Fishman Public Relations and Marketing, really great efforts. We've been with them now for a couple of years. in various aspects, France Summit and Franchise Today. Really appreciate all that Brad and Sherry do, as well as Deborah Gokas and of course, our account representative, Sarah Schulte. Really pleased with the job they've done with us. And then Franchise Update Media Group, really want to share some thanks to Steve Olson and Therese and Gary Gardner, because they've now stepped up and are now our new franchise strategic partner for Franchise News. So every week they'll be providing us some information. And, of course, they were also instrumental in getting Ed Waller onto our June series. So we really appreciate that. And our newest partner just came about this week, Jeremy LeDuc and the team at Elements Local. Of course, our co-founder, the co-partner in France Summit, is now our technology partner here on Franchise Today. And along those lines, Jeremy and I have a strategic planning meeting next week, and we'll be soon to announce our third annual France Summit, which will be in September. We'll just firm up the dates. Coming up in franchising, of course, we have the Franchise Finance Series by Franchise Times Magazine next week in Las Vegas. If you're not yet tired of going to Vegas this year, maybe after this trip you will be. And then two great marketing conferences coming up. FranCamp in Atlanta towards the end of May. I'll be on a panel there, as well as my guest today, Lee Plave. I know he'll be a facilitator there as well. Always going to be good to see him in person. We like talking on the phone, but never get really a chance to sit down and talk. So I'm looking forward to that beyond today. And then, of course, in June is the Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference by our strategic partner, Franchise Update Media Group. And, of course, June wouldn't be the same the last 2 years without the International Franchise Expo in New York. So really an exciting time. And as I said, today's guest is Lee Plave. It's our third time on Franchise Today during our legal series. He's the co-founding partner of Plave Cook PLC, an entrepreneurial law firm in Reston, Virginia, and as they like to refer to the law firm with Zing, and I truly believe that. Lee counsels franchisors and distributors, drafts and negotiates agreements for international and domestic transactions, advises clients on all aspects of franchise and distribution law. The IFA Educational Foundation recognized Lee as a certified franchise executive. London-based Chambers and Partners, which publishes an internationally respected client guide, ranks Lee as one of the leading franchise lawyers in the United States. Another London-based publication, Newsweek Legal, named Lee one of the global top 10 franchise lawyers in the international who's who of franchise lawyers. I couldn't agree more with that. In 2012, Lee was appointed to serve as the director of the International Division of the American Bar Association's Forum on Franchising, 2012 to 2014. Lee, welcome back to Franchise Today.
Thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate your having me as well. And let me echo your comments and your concern and genuine compassion for the folks who are going through such a tough time in Texas and obviously in Boston as well. Our hearts and thoughts are with them all.
Thank you. You know, for some reason or another, it seems like but we have representatives from Plave Cook on, and we're, of course, at times we joke about it, you know, tongue in cheek, but you know, it's the seriousness of the world today. I know last year when we had John Tifford on, there was a bomb threat across the parking lot from Plave Cook. That was kind of almost catastrophic for us, and certainly could have been catastrophic if it was a real bomb situation. But I mean, this is just, you know, just an unbelievable changing world, and just as some of you I know follow me on Facebook last night, I just said, you know, I'm putting on the headphones, shutting the TV, because it's so hard to deal with. It really is. And I know, Lee, you've got several of your children attending universities up in Boston. I could only imagine what you must have been going. Can't imagine what you were going through when you got news, and then probably had a hard time getting in touch with them.
Fortunately, they answered the phone on the first ring, and they told me they were well and safe. But I must say that sending a note to your friends a text or an email or whatever it might have been to say G-O-U-O-K, it brings you to the point where you realize how tenuous things can be and how much you've really got to appreciate what you've got. So it is a tough time, but we will all be stronger at the end of it. But clearly, this is a difficult period in our nation's history.
Absolutely. Everybody needs to realize there is much more good in the world than bad, and that's what we have to push towards. Realize the good of the world,
yep.
And the good will defeat the bad. And certainly don't want to go off on a tangent and be like Imus in the Morning or Howard Stern or anybody like that. So without further ado, let's jump in today's topic. And today's topic that I've been fortunate to speak with you on a couple of panels at some of the franchise expos, and it's really, unique in a sense that I talk with a lot of franchise attorneys, but yet every time I talk about data and information, we kind of center back to you, Lee. And so I guess the first question I would have right off the bat is an opinion question. And what really made me realize this, let me back up a second. Today, as I was promoting the show, as I often do, I obviously reminded people that we're going to be on it, of course, various social media. And Doug Smith, a well-known franchise professional, commented and he said, a topic more timely than many realize. And yet, nobody seems like they want to talk about it. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a very good question. The truth is that it's daunting to a lot of people. It's in the head. This is something, the topic of data and the challenges that franchisors face in connection with the data that they collect is genuinely something that most folks have a hard time getting their arms around. We face headlines every day indicating that the country is literally, potentially, and this sounds paranoid, but it's unfortunately the truth, literally under attack. In a cyber attack manner. We as business people, and of course in our primary roles as individuals, as consumers, as players in our society, are subject to that. And I suspect that at some level, most of us feel a sense of helplessness as to what we can do. The reality is there is quite a good bit that we can do, both in terms of being proactive and being responsible in collection, management, use, and dissemination of data. And if it's not enough to do it because it's something that you think you should do because it's the right thing to do, well, the unfortunate reality is that's what the law requires you to do. So you've got to get your arms around this one way or the other. But it is daunting.
It certainly is daunting, and I guess one of the first questions that we have to ask is, because we have obviously a lot of listeners that are new to franchising, a lot of their decisions are hinging on every word, it seems like, based on some of the emails and texts and phone calls that I get from them, and I'm really flattered that a lot of these newer franchisors are using the information that we share on Franchise Today, and specifically in the legal series, for their own internal training and knowledge and education. So it's great. But in a franchise world, how would you describe for the newbies to this, and probably for some of the old-timers, how would you describe data? What is data with respect to franchises?
Well, the data can be the typical way in which data is regulated is to consider what's called PII or personally identifiable information. That can be anything from, depending on where you, what kind of business you run, your customers' addresses. It could be your customers' credit card information. If you're in a business that does financing or touches financing, it could be the financing side of things. If you're in a business that touches upon the healthcare side of things, there are obviously considerable rules and considerable amounts of data that come through with respect to patients, their caregivers, their families, and the like. All of those factors come into play. And then, of course, your business is an organism of its own, and it has employees, it has vendors, it has relationships, and you as a business operator, leaving aside the franchise angle, have to consider the possibility that you need to make sure that your data in connection with the operation of your business is properly addressed as well. I think the most pressing thing that most people these days are paying attention to for many reasons is, however, credit card information. And that probably gets folks' attention more than anything else, I would say.
Yeah, without a doubt. It was, as we both know, Tom Feinstein over at Franchise Payment Networks on their Facebook page last night and read an interesting thing, and it just kind of triggered in my mind when you mentioned, you know, home healthcare business. And it was saying about, you know, credit card transactions, where in most cases, if you do a credit card transaction manually, you need to hold the information for a year or two for chargeback purposes. But yet, in the healthcare side, you have to hold it for a minimum of 5 years. So it seems like there's now starting to become even more of a separation as it relates to the home healthcare side of the industry. And obviously, we know there are a lot of growing franchise organizations in that space. And obviously, that's something that they're going to have to be more tuned into. It's not enough just to be in and think about this after the fact. It needs to be thought about very, very proactively.
Absolutely. You've got all of those interrelations, and then you've got the specter of finding that, you know, the credit card issuers, the MasterCards, the Visas, the Amexes, Discover, and JCB have a set of rules they have established for merchants who participate in their systems that require you to follow certain standards in terms of collecting, maintaining, keeping, and safeguarding credit card information. Now, the motivation for doing so is not hard to figure out if you think about it. The credit card issuers, as it's presently structured, are responsible for claims or the amounts that are spent by people who might steal your credit card. So if somebody was to heist my credit card and run up a tab on it, thankfully, that's not my responsibility. I think I'm responsible for the first small portion. I think it's $50 and I could be wrong about the dollar amount, but up until I've notified the credit card issuer that I've lost my card or that it's been stolen. But the credit card issuer is going to bear the brunt of it. The credit card issuers don't want to be in the business of insuring those kinds of losses. So what they're going to look to is to see whether or not somebody else is responsible for having created the dynamic in which that loss occurred. So why was my credit card information compromised? Maybe I left my card at some restaurant and it was literally picked off the table by a passerby. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the information was hacked out of somebody's computer, or it was stolen by an employee, or somebody wrote it down on a slip of paper next to the register when they took my information over the phone, and it was stuck in a pocket only to be removed by an employee later on and used for nefarious purposes. The credit card issuer is not going to be happy if it finds out that that's what's taken place, that it's been missing, that the data has not been securely handled by the merchant that I gave my number to, and they will look to be compensated because they don't want to be in the business of insuring these losses. So they're looking to recoup their losses, and they're trying at this stage to find a way. And you can understand, of course, why they're doing it, even though the consequences are somewhat difficult. They're trying to find a way to hold responsible the people who are, in fact, responsible.
Sure. Just recently, thinking about this and thinking about this and the effect on the individual business, there was a rerun segment of The Sopranos last week on HBO. And the restaurant, of course, that they go to that's owned by Artie Bucco, turns out that some gentlemen from American Express show up because of all the chargebacks, fraudulent charges on American Express cards, and they looked at a trend and it went back to the restaurant. And obviously, we know those type of things can easily happen, and they have happened. But the unique twist to this that I never thought of in thinking about these scenarios is just what you said. Obviously, the credit card company wants to get their money back. They're going to investigate this. But in this episode, what they did was they said, we're going to halt you being able to take American Express. And you think about the ramifications in a high-end restaurant being told abruptly, you can no longer take this credit card. Wow. That's, to use your word again, daunting, for sure.
Yep. That's exactly right. And as more and more transactions are conducted cashless, whether it's through credit cards, through the growing field of near-field communication using mobile devices to provide payment means or otherwise, the veracity of the information you get and the proper storage of the information you get, it becomes that much more critical. It's a lot easier when all you're doing is handing currency across the counter, but that's not where customers are these days, and you have to therefore build your business practices around the reality that you face.
Sure, absolutely. So with respect to credit cards, there are certain requirements. And I know the acronym on those are PCI-DSS requirements when it comes to handling credit cards. Can you please explain some of that?
I certainly could try, but the best place to look if somebody is trying to get their arms around this is the PCI Security Standards Organization has its own website, which is remarkably helpful, and I would encourage anybody who's trying to figure out the first elements of this or even advanced elements to keep on top of those details by going to the PCI website, which is PCISecurityStandards.org. And they have fantastic information that will be very helpful to you. The other places you can go are to some of the really outstanding vendors who are out there. And many of them are able to, and I don't want to mention any particular ones, even though I think we've all worked with some in the IFA's, at the IFA convention, there were some outstanding ones there. But the point is that there are people out there who are remarkably good at helping you navigate the waters here and make sure that you're in compliance. So I guess my advice to anybody would be, one, learn what the rules are about. Two, hire a professional with experience in the field who knows what she or he is talking about and who can help you manage the process, get yourself in compliance, and even if you think you're in compliance, help you make sure you stay in compliance. But generally speaking, what the PCI DSS standards are, and PCI DSS stands for PCI Payment Card Industry, DSS is Data Security Standard. Generally what they require is that you follow a certain set of procedures in terms of how you collect credit card information, what you do with the credit card information, and how you maintain it. I recently attended a conference where I ended up having to register at the registration desk at the conference rather than in advance. They jotted down my credit card information on a slip of paper. It was not distinguished as a credit card thing. I looked at it. It was a slip of paper that could easily get lost in a stack, including my expiration date, including the security code, with the right amount of money. Thankfully, they didn't ask me to sign it. But nonetheless, that information needed to have been instantly shredded once the use was made of it. And I don't know that they did or that they properly took care of it, disposed of it. Thankfully, I haven't had a loss of my credit card data, but ironically, I was at that conference to speak about PCI. You could imagine my surprise.
Yeah, that's very ironic. Well, you mentioned the PCI Security Standards Council, and on their site, they do offer robust and comprehensive standards and supporting materials to enhance payment card data security. Obviously, I'm reading off the site. These materials include a framework of specifications, tools, measurements, support resources to help organizations ensure the safe handling of cardholder information at every step. The keystone of the PCI Data Security Standard, PCI DSS, as you said, Lee, which provides an actionable framework for developing a robust payment card data security process, including prevention, detection, and appropriate reaction to security incidents. And if that is not enough to get somebody off their butt and go to the site and learn more and educate themselves and talk to some consultants in the industry, then I don't know what is, unless, of course, we talk about, you know, some of the potential consequences for organizations that don't look into this and find themselves between the proverbial rock and the hard place. What are some of the potential consequences, penalties, fines, et cetera, that an organization could be looking at?
Well, they come about in various different ways. One of them, of course, is that the credit card issuers may, under the terms of the merchant agreement, may look to the merchant for reimbursement and may, in fact, assess fines. We know of a company whose franchisee doing roughly $350,000 to $450,000 a year in gross sales was faced with a bill for about $110,000 from one of the credit card issuers due to significant violations relating to credit card data, where the losses where the failure to maintain credit card data led to consumers suffering losses, and therefore, I guess the most motivating part for the credit card issuer having to pay those amounts, or having to eat those amounts. So that's one is fines from the credit card issuers. The second one is you do expose yourself to liability from consumers, and that's not a pleasant situation to find yourself in. And the third one, depending on what you've represented to consumers, might be that you end up in a situation where a government agency comes at you for violating the promises that you've made. So, for example, if you promise to keep somebody's data secure because it's the only way to induce them to give you the data in the first place, but you fail to keep it secure, that's a violation of that's in essence false advertising, according to the Federal Trade Commission. And under Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, you might be facing an inquiry letter from an FTC staff lawyer. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to lose those cases, but you are going to have to spend some time and money answering questions. And therefore, those are serious implications and serious ramifications. The private litigation angle is one that I don't think we have seen fully explored quite yet. I've spoken with several colleagues who've handled cases in that regard, both involving franchise companies and those involving companies that are not franchised. And I think we are not yet done seeing claims that have been raised by consumers and other vendors who are somehow or another caught in the web of having to make payments or make remedial actions occur. And I think we're going to see more of that as time wears on, not less of it.
We are live today on Franchise Today. My guest is Lee Plave of Plave Cook in our fourth annual Franchise Legal Series. Today we're talking about compiling, utilizing, and protecting information and data. So, Lee, I guess based on what you're saying, despite denial by many people, is that, you know, people are being taken to task for these type of issues.
Well, this is just one of those inevitable realities that we all face. And much like maybe 15 or 20 years ago, our home budget didn't include a line item for cable television or satellite TV, satellite radio, mobile phone service, high-speed internet service, and perhaps a streaming data service, a streaming video service. You know, as business people, we face demands that weren't there years ago, and it's a question of making sure you act responsibly in connection with the demands that are placed upon you, and most importantly, the expectations of your customers with respect to the safety of transactions they have with you.
Well, obviously, when we talk about the expectations of customers and they look at franchise organizations, obviously it's a slightly different model than your typical B2B or B2C scenario, because there's another level, another confidence level in there, being the franchisor, even though the franchisee is the one providing the services. So with all that in mind, who ultimately is responsible for, you know, securing and properly utilizing all this data that might be gathered by the franchisees?
Well, I think that's the $64 question, or perhaps these days the $64 million question. You've hit the nail upon the head. There are answers at various different levels. So let's take them in pieces. First of all, there's brand exposure, and second of all, there's legal exposure. I would argue to you that the legal exposure is becoming harder to discern as to who is, in fact, the responsible party. For example, if we were all franchisees of Paul's Cookies, and I gathered data from my customers, and I mishandled the data, well, legally, my company, LeeCo, is not Paul's Franchising LLC, and Paul's Franchising LLC would have a good argument, at least, that it was not responsible for my mishandling of data. But that might change if I take the data and I share it with you. Or I take a cookie order and I have it filled through one of the other franchisees, but I do so through a common database maintained by you. Or you technically own the data, which is virtually the case in every franchise system, and is right, but nonetheless means that there is some degree of responsibility for that. All of those points get to the general notion that the business fiction we like to maintain, which is that franchisors and franchisees are part of one big happy system, is inconsistent with the legal reality, which is that there are in fact distinctions between franchisor entities and franchisee entities, and franchisee entities one to the other. So as we become more adept at sharing the data for legitimate and useful business purposes, the more we expose ourselves to the possibility that we have infected one another with our data violations, just as we might with anything else. So that's the legal part of it, and that might be a little bit obtuse, but nonetheless, that's the way it works. I think the bigger problem that companies and franchise operations face, unfortunately, is the more amorphous brand exposure. So again, if you're in a food service business like the proverbial Paul's Cookies, and it turns out that there's a threat to customers coming from something like a foodborne illness, we all deal with that as an existential threat to the business that we've invested in, both franchisees as well as the franchisor. That threat means that if we don't remedy it fast, solve the problem, and make sure it doesn't recur, all of us may suffer the consequences for quite some time to come at a business level. And then you wonder, why is it we would suffer the consequences? Well, the reason we suffer the consequences is because people come to associate our brand with something unpleasant. In this case, if it was in fact a foodborne illness, that very fact is enough to drive some customers away, maybe more than just a few. When you take other factors that have a similar impact, that is to say, driving customers away from the business, you have to consider their potential for damaging the brand's viability. And one of them would have to be, why would I not give my credit card company to Company A as opposed to Company B? If I knew that Company A had a history of data breaches, I might think twice before giving my credit card to the merchant at that business. So I think that credit card data loss is as much of an existential threat as anything else, and perhaps just behind foodborne illness, to the brands represented in a franchise system.
Very interesting. You know, this is the third year in a row you've mentioned Paul's Cookies, and I'm still waiting for my first royalty checks, and they haven't come in as of yet.
Well, we're working on the FDD. That's the problem.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Listen, when we get to 5 years, I want to make sure I get that jacket that Justin Timberlake got on SNL. I get a five
yeah,
jacket.
There you go. Five jacket. That was a good segment. You know, as we look at you know, all of this complexity and the way it extends, or maybe even better yet, it defines the relationships between franchisors and franchisors. I think, you know, a lot of people, again, to use your word, you know, look at this as very daunting. But really, I think it comes down to a very common denominator that really can make this much easier. And of course, the common denominator is, you know, open two-way communications between franchisee and franchisor, not waiting for something to blow up, but communicating, everybody being on the same page. And I think that obviously transcends to, you know, customer service and the customer experience, the whole nine yards. So I, you know, my word to my word of confidence to a franchisor and franchisees is to make sure that you're communicating. If there's an issue with customers, you know, don't ignore the emails, don't ignore the letters, respond to them right away, communicate with the franchisor, make sure everybody's on the same page. It's much easier to deal with it as a single issue than something that spirals out of control, and then obviously some regulatory agency gets their hands on it, starts looking at trends, starts looking at patterns, and all of a sudden you've got a holocaust of sorts. When we talk about, you know, documents, we talk about, you know, data, we have a lot of information, obviously, that comes to us from franchise candidates. And even more so today than in other years, franchise candidates are actually, you know, putting their franchise fee on a credit card. And often that credit card is not in the possession of the franchisor, meaning they do not swipe it, they do a transaction via the phone. What are some of the potential implications that could come out of this, you know, down the road if a franchise, now a franchisee, disputes that $15,000, $20,000, or $25,000 charge?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think if that were to come to pass, I think that a franchisor would have rather substantial remedies under the contract, because the contract says that I would have to pay you, as the franchisor of Paul's Cookies, the sum of let's say $30,000 as an initial franchise fee. If you're willing to pay the freight on that by having a credit card charge, or upcharge me under the new sets of laws for using a credit card, that's fine. But if I, for some reason or other, found that my check didn't clear, or that my credit card was rejected, or later on I took issue with it, you would have recourse against me.
Absolutely. I would imagine that that recourse could even potentially border on the line of fraud if so was the case.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case.
So you just mentioned something about the new law about charging up and above the amount of the credit card transaction. Can you give us a little bit of insight into that?
It's a little beyond my pay grade, but it's not as much a law as it is the result of a settlement among the people in the industry as to what rules the credit card issuers have imposed upon companies that use their credit cards. But as I understand it, the old limitation, which was that a merchant couldn't charge more for accepting a credit card than they could for accepting cash, has been wiped away, assuming people, in fact, follow the standards the credit card issuers have set. I think you start seeing these most frequently at gasoline stations when you pay at the pump.
Good point. I appreciate you clarifying that. And we won't allow you to, or we won't ask you to tell us what your pay grade is. You know,
all I know is I follow the Harry Callahan principle. A man's got to know his limits, and I know that's my limit.
You know, as we talk about data, we know that, you know, person's name, email address, other types of personal information are part of that, and a big way that data is moved around, obviously, is through email. And a lot of people, a lot of business owners, still don't understand the entire aspect of, you know, people opting in. You can't just spam people with email. I know Constant Contact has been doing a better job of late of actually closing down accounts where they realize they're just importing this massive list of 5 or 10,000 names, and they have not, you know, gotten the people to opt in. So what are some of your thoughts or suggestions or advice with respect to, you know, data and email?
Well, you've got several factors. Again, you've got legal considerations and you've got brand considerations. So the biggest consideration, I think, is the brand consideration. If somebody puts their business card in a fishbowl saying, yeah, I'd like to be considered for a drawing to get a free box of chocolates or a free car wash or whatever, and on the bowl it says, or maybe doesn't say, we'll take your information and use it to communicate with you, that may end up being an irritant to that individual. Now, mm-hmm. she or he may decide to do what is called opting out of that under the rules relating to email communications under the Canned Spam Act, but that applies to the business that, in fact, got their name. So let's say, for example, I'm a franchisee of Paul's Cookies, and a customer comes into my shop, drops a a business card into the fishbowl to be entered into a drawing, and whether they win or not, I send them an email afterwards thanking them for participating and offering them $1 off on their next visit or whatever the special is that I happen to be running. That's all well and good. They opt out, and I observe it. I'm careful about that sort of thing, and I actually observe it. Somebody else in the system buys a list, and on the list is that same customer's mailing address, the email address in particular, and they send a note to that franchisee offering them roughly the same deal, but not at my location, at a different location. Now, legally, there's a perfect distinction between my company and the other franchisee's company. So from a legal standpoint, the Canned Spam Act is not invoked. From a brand standpoint, you got a customer who said, I don't want to get any more emails from those SOBs who are spamming me. And he doesn't know the legal distinction between my business and the other franchisee's business. All he knows is the brand mm-hmm. name, Paul's Cookies.
Right.
He's not going to be a happy camper. So the issue is not just a legal one, but as with everything in franchise world, you've got to consider the brand implications. Whether it's PCI compliance, whether it's loss of data, or whether it's something as simple as sending out an email, you need to have coordination through a franchise system. What many sophisticated franchise systems do, of whatever size, because this is all scalable, is to one, set sensible policies; two, make certain that you have training, buy-in, and compliance throughout the system, retraining and all of that accountability. But, for example, there's a common database so that people, in fact, know that if Joe Jones has opted out, that Joe Jones has opted out for the brand, not for legal purposes, but for brand purposes. And that if Jane Jetson has opted in, she's opted in only for one particular place, but we know at least for the moment that she's okay. And you're not going to necessarily have an awful lot of different franchisees pinging her. You're going to have just one particular message. Now, that's on the spam email side, where you can easily opt out. And you don't have to opt in, so to speak, to email. You do, however, have the obligation as a business person to include a little bit of information about the process for opting out of a commercial email. Change that now to using text messaging for the purpose of communicating with your customers. There, the requirements with respect to opting out fall under a different law. First of all, you need an authorization because bear in mind that while you don't pay necessarily a separate fee to receive an email, you do pay, most of us do at least, some charge to receive a text message. Now, some of us have bulk text messaging programs and plans with our vendors like the Verizons and Sprints and AT&Ts of the world, so it doesn't come as a separate charge. But it is nonetheless considered a charge, and certainly many people pay on an as-you-text or as-you-receive-text basis. So you've got to, A, opt in, for the most part, although there are arguments to the contrary, but B, you've got to tell people how to opt out. So when you use texting for that purpose, it falls under a different legal standard, and that standard is a tougher one. And in fact, there are franchise companies that are now defending cases, meritorious defenses, I would add, but nonetheless having to go through the process of defending cases for the purpose of protecting themselves after having been sued for what some people are alleging are unauthorized text messages.
Wow. So, you know, there's so many different ways I'm sitting here thinking about of ways that franchisors and franchisees, you know, gather this data, this information, personal information from customers. With respect to social media, what does the law say as far as utilizing data? Because, I mean, I could see somebody responding to your blog and, you know, you're requiring them to give you their email address, requiring you to give them their, you know, your website. Obviously, you got to do a little bit more digging, but you can grab that information across just about every social media platform. So what type of responsibilities are on the franchisor and franchisee if they're the ones that are managing the social media program? What are some of the responsibilities, some of the things they need to look at?
Well, there are a couple of different platforms to consider. So if you're talking traditional social media of things along the lines of blogs and posts of that nature, you're going to probably find that the general rules pertaining to websites apply. If you're talking, on the other hand, of social networking sites, such as Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and things of that nature are involved, those sites have their own privacy policies and data use policies that typically will apply to their users as a general proposition. So if you're running your own website, whether it's formatted in the nature of a blog site or it's a conventional website, whether it's interactive or not, in many instances you're required to post your data and your the data collection policy, your privacy policy, and it's advisable that you also have a terms of use up on your website because people are, in effect, coming into your place of business, even if it's virtual, and you want to have the rules of the road for doing so. Certainly, absolutely, if you're selling something, services or goods through your website, you want to have a terms of use so that you control the nature of the transaction and you want to make sure that you're not, for example, hailed into court, pardon me, in some place where you have no idea that you were doing business because somebody happens to buy a product while sitting in a hotel room at that particular location, or ships a product to a remote customer as to whom you have no relationship other than the fact that you shipped it to them. So you want to be able to control where, for example, disputes would be heard and under what mechanism and so forth and so on. So you do have some both obligations as well as opportunities to protect yourself and to explain yourself to people. Here's the cutting. Here's where the sword cuts. Here's where it becomes an issue. If you set expectations, you have to meet the expectations. The cases in which the Federal Trade Commission has taken a step toward enforcing law against companies that have engaged in violations, they've lost credit cards, they've had violations of their privacy policies, don't come about because the privacy policies were violated per se. They come about because if you say you have a privacy policy and it's going to be A, B, and C, and you don't do A,
right.
B, and C, then that's false advertising. And that's where the FTC's mm-hmm. jurisdiction comes in.
That's interesting. I'm glad you clarified that, because it is all about the expectations. So, obviously we know about, data, social security numbers, driving license numbers, phone numbers, email addresses, et cetera. How does that apply from the standpoint of consumers, customers, individuals posting pictures online and specifically within a franchisor's own social media? Are the franchisors allowed to use those pictures now that they're posted on their site? Where does that fall in?
Paul, you only ask the easy question, so this is not a problem in the slightest bit to address.
I told you we're going to need a bigger boat.
Yeah, we're going to need a bigger boat. Well, the answer to that is a big, gigantic question mark, because there are various rules of the road that are not clear. So, for example, let's say you're a restaurant, and you post pictures of the patrons at your restaurant who are enjoying a nice evening out. If you're the one who took the photos, you're now potentially using their likeness, and potentially even exposing who is your guest at a restaurant, which sometimes might not necessarily be what they want, in a public forum. And if you don't have a release both as to the use of the photos and as to the use of their likeness, you might have an issue. On the other hand, if I have a nice dinner with some friends at a restaurant and I post a picture and mention that we had dinner at the other night I had dinner with some friends from college at the Daily Grill in downtown Washington. If I mention that that's where we are and it shows up on their webpage, I posted it. What argument could I then make that I wasn't authorized to post the picture that I took? Both as to the copyright, which I as the photographer hold, and as to any objection relating to the use of the likenesses, I'm responsible for putting it there, so they are not necessarily responsible for allowing it to stay. However, if they want to repurpose that, that's an interesting question. Now, mm-hmm. you know that Facebook a couple of months ago issued a statement as to its privacy policy, and they were pilloried for saying out loud that which is inherent in every website. If you post something onto my site, it becomes my property, and I could do with it what I want. That's the general rule of thumb in most instances, as it's understood. But it's not necessarily consistent with the law of copyright, and it's not necessarily consistent with what people's expectations may be. So I don't know the answer to the question that you've posed, because I don't think mm-hmm. the courts have fully sorted it out yet. Make it more complicated. I have my daughter's birthday party at a restaurant, and I take photos of all the kids running around and having a good time, and I post it up there. The business at which we had the party, let's say it's one of the neat places that does a great job of catering to kids and, you know, giving them a great opportunity to sort of bounce around on inflatables and things like that. They have a ton of fun. The business takes the photos and makes them available on its web. I put it up on the Facebook page. They copy the photos and put it up on its website. That's potentially permitted, and it's potentially not permitted. I would tend to think that you're going to probably run into a problem if you don't have a photo release from the individuals whose children are depicted in that picture. You've got to be careful in this regard, because, again, you've got expectations that people have as to the use of their likenesses, certainly when it comes to their children, and you've also got the issue of whether you, in fact, as the person that are using a photo, own the copyright in that.
Yeah, absolutely, especially sensitive in the children's space. And there are so many mommy bloggers out there writing about their families and, you know, are tagging the business they went to. They're taking the pictures. They're all over the Internet. And as a lot of people are doing nowadays, doing a Google search for images and videos, obviously there's a lot of that information. And, and content and images that are popping up and being shared. And I specifically see this a lot by businesses. If somebody posts a picture of them and their child having fun at one of these places, as you described, they're taking it off, meaning the business is taking it off the Facebook page and just repopulating it into their Pinterest page saying, you know, basically look at the fun these people are having. It's really... I'll tell you, you got to shake your head and just think of all the possibilities here. And I guess, you know, it's like anything else. I think common sense comes into play, too, that if a parent or an individual in that circumstance, you know, says, hey, look, I don't want that there, take it down.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and not argue, oh, well, this is on my site, and I have, you know, just take it down.
It's a branding issue at that point. And look, we could develop the forms so that if every kid who walks in every kid who walks into a lot of these places signs a little form that says that they accept the responsibility for the possibility they may hurt themselves if they're jumping on a trampoline and they twist an ankle or bend their wrist the wrong way. You can add to that the proper disclosure so that you have a photo release. But the truth of it is, as you say, if it's a brand issue, if somebody's going to, you know, find that it's objectionable to them after the fact, there's no sense in arguing that point.
Sure.
It's not you're not dealing with legal issues. You're dealing with branding issues, and you do what's smart for your brand and be very judicious about it. And it points to another factor to bear in mind, and that is these are all issues and matters that can be addressed to some extent by setting expectations as between businesses and their patrons and having documents in place so that you are, in fact, legally protected. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't do the right thing when you're requested to take a picture down by somebody, but at least you've got the right structure in place so that you're not completely left exposed to the possibility that somebody comes and says, take it down, oh, and by the way, pay me for the use of the likeness all up till now.
Right.
So it militates in favor of getting it right and treating these informal media with the degree of seriousness that they deserve because they're advertising media. And you would no sooner put a picture in an ad published in the Wall Street Journal or New York Times than you should put a picture in a display on Facebook, although it's an easier medium in which to manipulate content.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And we hear all along, you know, content is king, content is king, content is king. Recently I said, if it's king, then data is queen, and they need to work together. You heard that here, Lee. So the other day on the Masters, there's an IBM commercial that stated, you know, looking at data is one thing, knowing what to do with it is another game altogether. And I thought, wow, that's so timely in light of our discussion here today. And I think, you know, knowing what to do with it obviously is twofold. Number one, knowing what to do with it for business purposes, how to use it to obviously, you know, grow your business and build a nice sustainable business, but also knowing what to do with it from the standpoint of protecting it is obviously is a whole nother game altogether, and I think we somewhat scratched the surface today. Like I said, we needed a bigger boat. Probably could talk about this for several more hours, but we are at the 90-second mark, and so we have to call it a day. Lee, I really appreciate you being here today, and I really appreciate what you and your partners at Clive Cook have done in supporting franchise today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for giving us a chance to have this great conversation with you. We enjoy it tremendously.
I appreciate it and look forward to seeing you soon at FranCamp, I guess, in Atlanta will be the next time we get a chance to see each other. So,
And discuss many of these issues as well.
Yeah, same here. Absolutely. Next week, my guest is Amy Chang of Chang Cohen. We'll be talking about private equity and finance and franchising, which will kind of coincide with the Franchise Finance Conference going on in Las Vegas. Until then, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. franchise today is out.